This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty On Demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Jesse Kelly Show.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show. Let's honor the fallen on a Memorial Day. It is Monday. It is Memorial Day. And today is a day where we dedicate the entire show to the people who died in service of this country. We are going to talk about combat, history. I'm going to read citations, Distinguished Service Cross, and Medal of Honor. And we'll talk some Korea. We'll talk some Vietnam, some global war on terror, maybe even some World War II. We have more names than I may be able to get to during the show of names you emailed in of people you want honored. And I'm going to try to chop away at all that. But this is not like our normal shows, as you can probably already tell, where we goof off and talk politics. There won't be any of that today. I may play some comments from Trump or Vance or Hegseth just because they had some wonderful things to say. But I wanted to make sure you knew, as a reminder, maybe even this is your first time tuning in, that today is a sacred day. I believe it's sacred. We believe we have a responsibility here on this show to honor those who gave their lives for this country on this day. And so that's why we come in. We do a special Memorial Day show. There won't be any ads. Well, I mean, there'll be commercial breaks, but there won't be any live reads. There'll be nothing but history and honoring the fallen. And if I may, really quickly, I want to speak to the families who may be hurting today. In fact, Trump actually had something wonderful to say about that.
For the families of the fallen, you feel the absence of your heroes every day and the family. These are great families. These are wonderful families. In the familiar laugh, no longer heard, the empty space at Sunday dinner, or the want of a hug or a pat on the back that will never come again. Every Gold Star family fights a battle long after the victory is won, and today we lift you up and we hold you high. Thank you, thank you, thank you for giving America the brightest light in your lives. It's what you've done. We will never, ever forget our fallen heroes, and we will never forget our debt to you.
I want to talk to you if you're one of those family members, and I know we have many Gold Star families who listen to the show. Because, you know, I heard for the longest time in my life, I had heard people say around different holidays, like Christmas, for example, that this day, please remember, this day can be heavy for people. And I'll be frank with you, I got what they were saying, and I never argued with it, but it didn't actually... I didn't fully realize what they were talking about until this past Christmas when my father was gone. And all of a sudden, it was the first Christmas without my dad. Memorial Day to people who have lost a family member or a close friend. Yes, it's a day where people gather and celebrate, but this is a painful, heavy day for a lot of people where... Yes, they like it and they respect it, but they look around everywhere with the flags and the celebrations and the tombstones and the stories even that all tell tonight, and it hurts because it is a reminder of what you gave up, of what the person you lost gave up and what you gave up. You gave up your husband. Your kids gave up their father. You gave up your son.
and you don't get to enjoy them ever again on this earth. And that hurts. And for them who gave their lives, it's been said before by others, but I'll repeat my own version of it. It's about what they gave up. I'll tell you, it hits me hard. Like this morning, actually yesterday morning, got up and I took my sons to Waffle House. Just something dumb. You know, we were awake and we were hungry. Let's go get some Waffle House. And I knew Memorial Day was coming up. And I thought about guys I knew my age, guys I was with who are gone now, and they don't get to go to Waffle House with their sons. And really, I know I probably shouldn't have, but it made me feel a little bit guilty in a way. A real bad case of survivor's guilt. Here I am with my two sons, and my buddies gave it up. They don't get to do that. If you are one of those family members today or close friends who are hurting today, just know that the prayers of the Jesse Kelly Show family, all of us here, everybody listening, we are with you. And I know that may be a small comfort, but it is the only comfort we can give on a day that hurts. So respect to you and respect to the fallen. So again, a heads up as to how this show is going to run. We're going to talk a lot of war history. I'm going to do a fairly basic War 101 history on these different conflicts to try to give some concept of what was happening and what these men gave up their lives for. We're going to read some Distinguished Service Cross citations tonight, Vietnam, Korea, Global War on Terror, other things. Yes, Chris is warning me about the volume of names we have. Remember, I told you to email in the names of the fallen, name, rank, and conflict, because we want to try to read all of them on air and honor them. There are a lot. The show has grown quite a bit over the 6 years we've been doing it. It may be hard, okay? But I'm going to try to get to every single name. The email's like this. Jesse, my great-uncle Melvin Thomas Windham. My grandfather told me his body finally made it back to Shelby County, Texas. His mother didn't believe it was his body. It was common for pieces or parts to be sent back, so on and so forth. Again, that's a common thing. Emails like this one. Fred D. Smith, sergeant from Wisconsin, Vietnam War. Fred worked with me in a large rural cemetery, readying it for 1968 Memorial Day services, mowing and clipping around the headstones and placing the American flag at the veterans' graves. I was a junior and he was a senior. He enlisted in the Army and went to Vietnam a few months later. I would be taking care of his grave for the next few Memorial Days, and there were several other men in my high school that luckily made it back. So guys like Fred D. Smith are who we're going to honor today. Now let's begin. We're actually going to begin with the Korean War, and before I get to these citations and start reading off names, I want to give a recap. Again, for people who know history or who listen to this show a lot, some of this stuff may be basic and stuff you know, but a lot of people don't know. And a lot of schools don't provide a decent historical perspective. So let's just talk Korea and how we ended up in that terrible, terrible war known as the Forgotten War, and men who gave their lives over there during that Forgotten War. I know we have Korean vets who listen. So first, post-World War II. It's a very fascinating time in the world. Just think for a moment what the world is going through after it gets to breathe a sigh of relief, Japan finally surrenders, and the world has just fought a global war. Think of all the death, all the destruction, all the financial ruin in various parts, from Russia to the UK to Japan. They're rebuilding cities all across Europe and Africa. Crazy amounts of rubble and lives lost and families lost and refugees. Okay, so there's this really terrible period of time during and post-World War II where the world is trying to figure things out. How do we rebuild? How do we pay for everything? What do we do? And the world's trying to figure out how to structure itself and it's trying to figure out how to structure itself. And there are different things at play. You have Stalin running the Soviet Union. So, look, he's not as nostalgic about the entire thing. He wants to grab territory. So you're fighting against that. There's a lot going on. And part of a lot going on is the world starts to unload its militaries. Militaries are extremely expensive. I mean, look at our budget right now. They're proposing $1 trillion for the military alone. Armies now and always are expensive. It costs a lot to raise them, to pay them, to equip them, to feed them. Militaries are very, very expensive things. They're a luxury only wealthy countries really can share the burden of. And countries couldn't afford it, including us, after World War II. So everyone starts dumping their military. Let's disband, get rid of this, get rid of this, get rid of that. But there's trouble brewing over there in Korea. And we'll talk about that next.
Jesse Kelly.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a wonderful, wonderful Memorial Day as we sit here and we talk about the conflicts and the men and the things they gave up. And we are honoring the fallen for 3 hours today. And right now we're about to talk a little bit about Korea. I'm going to try to give as a brief a recap on these conflicts as possible just because there's so much to get to. But I want people to understand the conflict itself and what was happening in the world. Post-World War II, the world is broke. The world is in rubble. They're drawing down their militaries. They can't afford, nobody can afford it anymore. No one wants these large standing armies. We're figuring out what's going on. But in Korea, they've got a problem, you see. In Korea, the northern part is governed and dominated by an evil communist. It's the Kim family, in case you're wondering, just to spoil it for you. And surprise, surprise, the communists in North Korea are looking at South Korea and saying to themselves, well, I want it. I think I'll go take it. I don't want half of Korea. I actually want all of Korea. Now, the world, I said the world was going through some things, and I said that to say this. World War II was so awful. As men, especially men who are getting older and grayer like I am, as men, we tend to idolize and lionize World War II, and I am the most guilty of that. I'm not pointing fingers. But we do lose sight sometimes of the fact that it really was the most horrible thing the world has ever gone through. Ever. I don't know that there's ever anything that happened that brought that much death and misery and destruction and sadness and just awful things. And the world, when it hurts like that, wants to make sure, it's very common, wants to make sure it will never have to hurt like that again. You know, how many times have you heard, you know, it's not just a post-Holocaust rallying cry for Jewish people, never again. You know, that's a rallying cry, very common. That's a common rallying cry for human beings whenever they go through something terrible. Never again, never again can we allow this to happen because it hurts so badly. And so you're looking around, the world's looking around, and they want to make sure, how do we ensure that never again are we going to have to fight this global, horrible thing? Well, we need a couple things. First, we need a group of countries. Like the nice countries, that's the civilized countries, they'll come together and they'll mediate everything. You know, United Nations time, baby. And something else, on top of this group of countries, we need to make sure nobody is ever allowed to invade another spit of ground on the planet ever for any reason at all. That was, I mean, it's a mindset that we very much share to this day with the Russia-Ukraine stuff, but that was the mindset then. No country can raise an army and cross the borders of another country and invade. If that happens, it must be stopped at any cost. If it's not stopped, it will end up like Hitler storming through Europe. Again, an overreaction, but an understandable reaction to a world, or by a world, that had just suffered the way this world suffered. North Korea invades South Korea, and the United Nations decides, hey, it's time to get involved. We have to put a stop to this. But putting a stop to this, it's not letters. It's not speeches. If there's a standing army with guns and bombs and men willing to kill, then you are going to need guns and bombs and men willing to kill to stop it. Surprise, surprise, the United States of America was looked to shoulder this load. They looked to the United States of America and said, hey, the United Nations, kind of mostly America, you need to go help. America sent the troops. We didn't have the troops, remember. Remember, we were busy unloading our military as well. So a lot of these men, when I read some of these things, these guys are freshly in. Some are World War II veterans. Some are freshly in. But we were so short on troops for Korea. Marines were finishing Marine Corps boot camp on the ships on the way over to Korea. That is the definition of green. You don't know anything when you finish boot camp except how to tie your boots. You don't know squat, and you are going into hell. So North Korea by now had invaded South Korea, and they were pushing the South Koreans clear down towards the tip. And then Douglas MacArthur had a good idea. Again, everyone thinks I hate MacArthur's guts. It's not true. It's not really true, Chris. He had a good idea. A very common idea in combat. His idea was, well, why don't we land behind them? Land behind them. Cut off their supply. Not only do you cut off your supply route of your enemy when you land behind them, but you are now behind them. I know that kind of sounds like an obvious point, but you have created for him a two-front war. Now he has enemies to his front, and now he has really powerful enemies to his rear. And we land behind them, and we start stomping the Koreans. And we start running them up north. And now military brass, MacArthur and those types, now they decide, well, we have an army. It's here. We've got these dirty communists on the run. They're heading back north. There aren't that many of them. Why don't we go after them into the north and smash them completely? Maybe we'll even sniff around China, which is just north of North Korea. Except Mao was running China at this time. Mao was already angry with America for our backing of the nationalists he had previously defeated in Korea. And Mao was understandably nervous about an American army making its way to the Chinese border. So Mao decided to get involved. And this is when Korea really turned into a living hell for our guys. Hang on.
The Jesse Kelly Show. On air and online at jessekellyshow.com.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a Memorial Day. Just to remind you that there's a lot of names. There's a lot to get to today. I'm going to try the best I can to get to all of it. But because there is so much to get to, I am only going to play taps one time this show, and it's going to round out the show. It's going to be at the end of the third hour. We're going to play taps to honor all of these fallen men we're talking about, and then we will sign off for the day back to our regularly scheduled programming tomorrow. Back to Korea before we start reading some of these citations. It's one of the creepier things in combat, or things that I've read about in combat, and I'll put it to you this way. When you think there's not somebody there, and then you start to sniff that there may be someone there, and then you start to get the idea that maybe there's a lot of people there and a lot more coming. As we ventured into North Korea, our military units, Army, Marine Corps, we started to find Chinese soldiers. We started to take Chinese prisoners. Some of them had been captured. Some of them had simply gone AWOL and tried to escape. And our military starts to get intelligence from these men that there are a lot of Chinese soldiers pouring into North Korea. At first, we were getting numbers like 100,000, 200,000, 300,000, numbers so big the numbers weren't believed. In fact, it went clear up the chain of command to MacArthur, who was running things. And he and his guys said, "What? That's crazy. No way. There's no way." Except it was true. Remember, Mao, as big of a piece of trash as he was a seasoned, experienced fighter. He knew America had air power, which he did not have. And so he waited until nighttime to bring his men in waves down into North Korea. During the day, they would do things like sleep in tunnels where they found them or tie themselves to trees so the planes flying overhead couldn't see. Our guys were heading up into, we don't know a number, 400, 500,000 Chinese troops, and our guys are heading into the frozen mountains. The frozen mountains, and there aren't very many ways up there, and there aren't very many ways back. As our guys pour into the mountains of North Korea, the Chinese communists are coming in waves, and they are surrounding our men. Now, up to this point in time, I don't want to be dismissive of what the fighting was like, but up to this point in time, it was standard fighting, and it was about to be as bad as anything you've ever seen or heard. In fact, let's read a couple Distinguished Service Cross citations, shall we? This is for a John S. Carson of Washington, D.C. The President of the United States takes pride in presenting the Distinguished Service Cross posthumously to John Spencer Carson, 2nd Lieutenant, U.S. Marine Corps, for extraordinary heroism in connection with military operations against an armed enemy of the United Nations while serving with Company A, 1st Battalion, 1st Provisional Marine Brigade Reinforced, Fleet Marine Force Pacific, in action against enemy aggressor forces near Tangsan, Korea, on the 3rd of September, 1950. Pause real quick, just a heads up. All these Korean citations are going to reference the United Nations. Try not to sneer too hard. That's the way the citation had to be written because technically it wasn't us, it was the UN. Okay, all right. During an attack on an enemy position, 2nd Lieutenant Carson, acting as a tank liaison officer, I'll explain that in a moment, observed that the platoon commander and platoon sergeant of a supporting tank platoon were seriously wounded. Unhesitatingly, he assumed command of the platoon and skillfully continued in support of the attack. Shortly afterward, when the tank was hit by enemy anti-tank fire and began to burn, Lieutenant Carson grabbed a fire extinguisher and, disregarding his own personal safety, fearlessly and courageously climbed out of the tank in the face of intense hostile fire and extinguished the blaze, thereby saving the tank and the lives of the crew. In his intrepid action, he was struck in both legs by enemy small arms fire, which knocked him from the tank to the ground. Despite his severe and painful wounds, he refused to be evacuated and, crawling forward to the high ground, he directed the devastating fire of his tanks against enemy positions until he was mortally wounded. The dude was shot in both legs and he just crawled on top of a mountain and directed fire until they killed him. I just want to explain something about this, a couple things about this. Armor, tanks, well, I'll just say tanks so it's easier to understand. Armor by itself on the battlefield, they're just a bunch of sitting ducks. I know that sounds weird. And I know people, if you're not aware of this kind of stuff, you may wonder, well, why don't we just gather up 100 tanks and put everyone in the tanks and just drive the tanks forward and kill everybody? Well, see, tanks are unbelievably vulnerable to anti-tank mines. They'll create anti-tank minefields. And there's all kinds of anti-tank weapons available out there that can take out a tank. Now, pause on that. Vice versa. Infantry without armor. You know, me, you, just flesh and blood human beings without armor. Obviously extremely vulnerable. I don't know about you. Bullets don't bounce off my skin. Shrapnel tends to hurt quite a bit. Also extremely vulnerable. But when you combine armor and infantry, That can be very advantageous if you have to assault a machine gun position. Well, you get in behind the tanks. Machine gun bullets are bouncing off the tanks. The infantry's using the tank for cover. You approach the machine gun position. Bop, bop, bop. Maybe even the tank gun takes it out. Vice versa. The anti-tank weapons that are out there. Oftentimes, it's, you know, RPGs type things, rocket launchers, that type of stuff. The infantry can spot it, and infantry can take it out before it takes out all of your armor. You use each other to protect each other. And if you ever read Korean War stories, there are endless Korean War stories of infantry guys saving tank guys. Tank guys saving infantry guys. Myself, when I was, this is not about me, but when we were going into Iraq, and we were 2 weeks, I think, into Iraq, and we were approaching Baghdad, my company, 1st Battalion, 7th Marines Alpha Company, they snatched us from our battalion and they attached us to a tank unit because they couldn't have a tank unit going into Baghdad without infantry support, and they didn't want an infantry unit going into Baghdad without tank support. You see, so that's how it works. But as we talked about so many times before, tank guys, they're not only not safe, they burn to death a lot. I lost a friend of mine in Iraq, Lance Corporal Rodriguez, Semper Fi, my brother, and Semper Fi to his family if they're listening. He didn't burn. He drowned. Dust storm, you can't stop. Stopping's not an option. Had to cross a bridge, couldn't see. I remember that dust storm like it was yesterday. Right into the river. Died there. It's a dangerous thing. It's not a safe thing. Don't think it's a safe thing. It's a dangerous thing to be in a tank. What do you think everyone's shooting at? What do you think everyone wants to take out? If you're pulling guys out of tanks and getting shot to pieces and crawling forward to help, it's an awesome thing. John S. Carson. In fact, I'm going to read a couple more from Korea. Then we're going to try to move on to some other things in just a moment.
Jesse Kelly.
It is the Jesse Kelly Show on a Memorial Day. Talking a little bit of Korea now, doing some Korean War, Distinguished Service Cross citations, and just another update on the Korean War. Remember, as we went up into North Korea and the Chinese surrounded us, the Korean War became a battle for survival. We were up there thinking we were going to invade, and reality, we were being surrounded, outnumbered beyond belief. In this frozen, mountainous area, it became a battle for frozen hilltops. You have to grab them, you have to hold them, and you have to know that the Chinese will be coming in waves. And the Korean War is one of the wars where you constantly read stories about guys who are dug in. Let's say they're in a defensive perimeter, they're dug in, and the Chinese start blowing whistles. That's how they signaled things. That's how they communicated for the most part. Blowing horns and whistles. Imagine it's the middle of the night. It's 30 below zero. You're on a hilltop, dug in, freezing. You can't feel your hands with your friends. And the horns start blaring and the whistles start going. And somebody shoots off a flare. And like a scene out of a freaking horror movie, you look down and there are thousands of Chinese running up the hill with guns and bayonets to kill you and all of your friends. You start killing them as fast as you possibly can. They're landing in your trench with you. You're hand-to-hand fighting. And at one point, they get through your lines. This happened all the time in Korea because there were so many of them. They get through your lines. So you have to do the unthinkable and grab your weapon and turn it around and fire inside of your lines because there are Chinese troops all over the place. And you find yourself praying to God, as I have watched. In fact, I watched this in a documentary, as I watched a Korean War veteran describe. He prayed to God as they were all around him dying, his friends dying, them dying. And all he prayed was, God, let me see the sun one more time. Then we read citations like this for a Joseph T. O'Donnell from Kings, New York. The President of the United States takes pride in presenting the Distinguished Service Cross posthumously to Joseph T. O'Donnell, 1st Lieutenant Infantry, U.S. Army, for extraordinary heroism in connection with military operations against an armed enemy of the United Nations while serving with Company A, 1st Battalion, 38th Infantry Regiment, 2nd Infantry Division. First Lieutenant O'Donnell distinguished himself by extraordinary heroism in action against enemy aggressive forces at Mundungni, Korea, on the 13th of October, 1951. On that date, Company A launched an assault on a strategic hill strongly defended by a determined enemy. Lieutenant O'Donnell led his platoon until they were halted by a heavy barrage of enemy small arms and mortar fire. Unhesitatingly and with complete indifference to the intense fire, he placed himself at the head of his platoon and led them at a renewed assault, during which he charged and destroyed an enemy position and killed its occupants with his rifle and grenades. Although wounded by an enemy grenade, he continued to lead his men in the attack. Knocked down by a second grenade, he immediately arose again and continued to direct his men in the assault. In the platoon's final charge, he was fatally wounded by mortar fragments. His bravery and spirited leadership were an inspiration to all who witnessed his actions and contribute immeasurably in the successful completion of the mission. Let me pause for another moment and read some names of the ones that got sent in. I haven't read any yet, and I'm way behind. These are from some miscellaneous conflicts, so I'll name the conflict. The others, I'll do it by the name of the conflict. Specialist Jerry Daves, Panama, or Davies, sorry, I don't know. Private First Class Martian Denson, Panama. Corporal Richard Villahermosa, probably, Panama. This is this one's called Blue on Blue. That would be friendly fire. That's very, very common in combat. I just said, sometimes you have to turn your weapon around. Sometimes accidents happen. It's very common. It's no less heroic. Sergeant Carson Holmquist, terrorist attack, that one in Chattanooga. Airman Trevor Mackey, training accident. Lance Corporal George Dramas, Beirut. These two are from the Revolutionary War. Stephen Crosby, both captains. Captain Stephen Crosby, Captain Herman Cummings, Sr. These are from the Civil War. Private Lafayette Bray, Civil War. Tim Perkins, Civil War. Riley Perkins, Civil War. Robert McMenamin, Civil War. These are from World War II. Private William Moore. Private Abner Spear. Private Arjo Axford. Private William Buell. This is from World War II. Staff Sergeant Salvatore Luciano. Private Gail Charles. Staff Sergeant Verfel Brown, Corporal Leo Forcier, Corporal Edwin Wirtz, Major Jack Mathis, Private Alton Cook, Staff Sergeant Elmer Hessman, Staff Sergeant Bobby Midwary, Sergeant Roy Goodpaster Jr., Torpedoman's Mate 1, James Jones, Private Joseph Lessey, Captain Charles Tinley, Technician 5, Rankin Kellogg, Gunner's Mate, First Class, Clayton Neuendrop. And we'll get to more in just a little bit. I want to get to more of these Distinguished Service Cross citations. President of the United States takes pride in presenting the Distinguished Service Cross posthumously to George Andrew Davis, Jr., Major, U.S. Air Force, for extraordinary heroism in connection with military operations against an armed enemy of the United Nations while serving as commander of the 334th Fighter Interceptor Squadron, 4th Fighter Interceptor Wing, 5th Air Force on the 27th of November, 1951, during an engagement with an enemy aircraft near Sinanju, Korea. While leading a group formation of 32 F-86 aircraft on counter-air mission, Major Davis observed 6 MiG-15 aircraft heading southward above the group. With exemplary leadership and superior airmanship, he maneuvered his forces into position for the attack, leading with great tactical skill and courage. Major Davis closed to 800 feet on a MiG-15 over Namsi, and he fired on the enemy aircraft, which immediately began burning. A few seconds later, the enemy pilot bailed out of his aircraft, continuing the attack on the enemy forces. Major Davis fired on the wingmen of the enemy flight, which resulted in numerous strikes on wing routes and the fuselage. As Mayor Davis broke off his relentless attack on this MiG-15, another MiG-15 came down on him. He immediately brought his aircraft into firing position upon the enemy, and after a sustained barrage of fire, the enemy pilot bailed out. Although low on fuel, he rejoined his group and reorganized his forces to engage the approximate 80 enemy aircraft, making the attack against overwhelming odds. Major Davis' group destroyed two other MiG-15s, probably destroyed one, and damaged one other. We continue next.
Why should you listen to Armstrong and Getty on demand?
We're not boring. A lot of news is boring.
And tedious.
And depressing.
And makes you angry. You don't want to live your life like that.
Hey, I'm Jack Armstrong. He's Joe Getty.
We're Armstrong and Getty.
We try to bring you the truth.
And help you figure out this crazy modern world.
How about something about a comedic tone?
We have a winner.
Yes. Listen to Armstrong and Getty on demand on the iHeartRadio app,
Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.